social bonds we share in community. The ancient biblical texts are given much lip service in America, but their social and political meaning receives little serious adherence or application. But the vision is always there, waiting for us to grasp, embrace, and implement. The vision is also in our own American traditions, in which democratic ideals have prevailed over their many obstacles. And when there has been a clear connection between our prophetic religious traditions and our democratic hopes, the vision becomes most clear. As, for example, when Martin Luther King Jr. changed America with a Bible in one hand and the Constitution in the other. The vision is there and merely awaits us. When we move toward our prophetic and democratic visions, slaveries are ended, civil rights achieved, freedom established, compassion implemented, justice advanced, human rights defended, and peace made. When we neglect the vision, greed triumphs, selfishness erodes common life, our divisions increase, our weapons expand, and our conflicts proliferate. When we come closer to the vision, our practice of citizenship is always enlivened. When we move away from it, apathy and withdrawal grow like a cancer in the body politic. Perhaps most importantly, when we embrace our best spiritual and political visions, the renewal of hope is the result. When we forget the moral visions that nourish our public life, cynicism abounds. Our faithfulness to the best of our prophetic and democratic visions seems to ebb and flow. Today, our fidelity to those visions is at one of its lowest ebbs. But the vision still awaits, and it's time to embrace it again for the sake of our personal and political renewal. Citizenship will not be revitalized merely by improved democratic techniques. It requires a return to the visions with the capacity to reform our public life. That is now our task. God is personal, but never private. And the Bible reveals a very public God. But in an age of private spiritualities, the voice of a public God can scarcely be heard. Private religion avoids the public consequences of faith. In particular, affluent countries and churches breed private disciples, perhaps because the applications of faith to public life could become quickly challenging and troubling. Can the devotees of private religion even understand the politics of God? So, is there a politics of God? Many of our politicians give a lot of lip service to God these days, but do they really understand the public implications of belief in God? We don't typically hear much about the politics of God, even from our pulpits. Powerful forces would keep God private, or under control, or as an endorser of ideological agendas, or of the political status quo, or worse yet, of fundraising activities. Today, religion usually serves more to silence the politics of God than to announce it to the nations. In the face of suicide bombers who utter the name of God with easy blasphemy, television evangelists who claim God has made them and could make you prosperous, and those who use religious institutions to hide hideous crimes, many search today, almost desperately, for true religion and good faith. The place to begin to understand the politics of God is with the prophets, the ancient moral articulators in the scriptures who claim to speak in the name of the Lord. What were their subjects? Quite secular topics, really. Land, labor, capital, wages, debt, taxes, equity, fairness, courts, prisons, immigrants, other races and peoples, economic divisions, social justice, war, and peace. The stuff of politics. Whom were the prophets often speaking to? Usually to rulers, kings, judges, employers, landlords, owners of property and wealth, and even religious leaders. They spoke to the nations, and it was the powerful who were most often the prophet's target audience. Those in charge of things were the ones called to greatest accountability, And whom were the prophets usually speaking for? Most often, the dispossessed, widows and orphans, read poor single moms, the hungry, the homeless, the helpless, the least, last, and lost. Is God into class warfare? No. God wants the common good. But speaking for the common good can get one accused of calling for class warfare, usually by the elites who control the political discussion and do not want too much conversation about what God thinks of our political priorities. The conflict over a private versus public God came early for me. I was born into an evangelical Christian family, raised in the American Midwest, and reared on Republican patriotism. We supported Eisenhower and not Stevenson for president. And I remember taking an early interest in history and politics. My father married his high school sweetheart on the same day he graduated from college and was commissioned as an officer in the U.S. Navy, which was eager to send him and his classmates into the Pacific theater of World War II. My dad believed the atomic bomb might have saved his life, as his destroyer minesweeper was slated for the invasion of the Japanese islands. When he returned home to Detroit, my mother and father started their family, and I was the first of five children. We soon moved into a new home, financed by the newly established Federal Housing Administration for returning servicemen and their new families, just like us. Our first home was on River Park, in Redford Township, and it seemed like all our neighbors were indeed just like us. That was the primary social reality that eventually broke apart my early view of the world. The thing that made us different than some was a strong Christian commitment that led my parents to help found a new church in the neighborhood. My father was an engineer for Detroit Edison, but also a pastor in the Plymouth Brethren Church, which had no clergy, but all lay leaders. I remember him getting up most mornings as early as 5 a.m. to study his Bible until the family got up at 7. My mother was also a gifted leader with natural pastoral skills. But the conservative church allowed no public role for women, who faithfully kept things together behind the scenes. It was my mother's admonitions that became the first building blocks for my emerging social conscience. Phyllis Wallace told her children to always do two things. First, if there was a child that nobody else will play with, you play with him or her, she ordered. It was like a rule of play for us. Nobody gets left out. Second, if there is a bully who is picking on other people, you stand up for them, she courageously commanded. Virtually all my fights in school were with bullies. She also seemed to tie these moral injunctions to our faith. It was what Jesus would have us do. Never do I remember either of my parents applying these life lessons to any political issue. And when I later tried to do that, they didn't understand, at least at first. But their values were clear social commitments nonetheless. An incident in my church left an indelible impression about the private versus public meaning of faith, and permanently altered my own life's direction. My church was all white, as was my neighborhood, my school, and my whole world. I began to notice this homogeneity as a young teenager, and for some reason it bothered me. In other books, I've recounted the story of my early conversion to Christianity at the age of 6 years, and how later teenage questions about the realities of race in Detroit led to a second conversion, and, indeed, led me out of the church. I was now regularly making the pilgrimage into inner-city Detroit, taking jobs in the city alongside young black workers my own age and visiting black churches. The incident came one day back in my home church when I was arguing with one of the elders about racism and the things I was learning in inner-city Detroit. I will never forget what he said to me. Christianity has nothing to do with racism. That is a political issue, and our faith is personal. I knew that the questions that were tearing at my heart were not going to go away, and if Christianity had nothing to do with them, I wanted nothing to do with Christianity. I left my childhood faith behind, and many in the church were glad to see me go, and found my new home in the civil rights and student movements of my generation. My return to Christian faith after years of political organizing is also described elsewhere, along with the founding of Sojourners Magazine and Community. But there was a deep lesson learned in my banishment and return to faith, and it would become the foundation for everything I would do thereafter. The lesson is this: God is personal, but never private. If God is not personal, there is little meaning to faith. It becomes a mere philosophy, or a set of teachings from religious figures who died long ago. Without a personal God, there is no personal dimension to belief. There is no relationship to God, no redemption, salvation, grace, or forgiveness. There is no spiritual transformation without a personal God, and no power that can really change our lives beyond mere self-improvement. In today's world, there is one overriding and key distinction in all of the religion that is growing: a God who desires relationship with each person. Much of liberal religion has lost the experience of a personal God, and that is the primary reason why liberal Christianity is not growing. And without a personal God, liberal faith will never grow. However, that personal God is never private. Restricting God to private space was the great heresy of 20th century American evangelicalism. Denying the public God is a denial of biblical faith itself, a rejection of the prophets, the apostles, and Jesus himself. Exclusively private faith degenerates into a narrow religion, excessively preoccupied with individual and sexual morality, while almost oblivious to the biblical demands for public justice. In the end, private faith becomes a merely cultural religion, providing the assurance of righteousness for people just like us. Most of the biblical prophets, whom we pass over week after week in our congregations, would offer a quite searing indictment of contemporary American society, specifically that we have become a nation of endangered souls, and that our society and politics are governed by values quite foreign to the heart of our religious traditions, no matter how religious we like to think we are. Whether conservative or liberal Christians, or members of other faith groups, or just spiritual seekers, we are all guilty of succumbing to a diminished religiosity that is characterized by privatized belief systems, devoid of the prophetic and social witness of Jesus and the prophets. Ultimately, nothing more than small-s spirituality that is really only ad hoc wish fulfillment or a collection of little self-help techniques we use to take the edge off our materialistic rat race lives. What is needed is nothing less than a renovation of our souls and the soul of our politics. We are all, right and left, pursuing our innocuous spiritualities, following our bliss, as the saying goes, as if religion meant nothing to our life together. Whether attending our Zen Christian retreats as progressives or our seeker-sensitive megachurches as conservatives, we've abandoned the heart of capital R religion. In essence, this recording is arguing a very evangelical point. Our souls and our society are in great need of transformation. But this is not a spiritualized critique. It is instead grounded in the politics of the Bible, in what authentic faith belief creates in terms of actions and lifestyle. Society and politics both shape and reflect our spiritual values, and these values are increasingly empty. How does a nation of endangered souls recover an authentic faith that is true to the gospel, the example of Jesus, the witness of the prophets, and the crushing needs of our times? What would such a recovery mean for evangelicals, mainline Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, seekers, and everyday people? What if everyday people made the politics of the prophets their litmus test for political candidates, and for fiscal, social, corporate, and foreign policy issues? Church and state can and must be separate in a modern democracy, but spiritual values still undergird everything and are reflected in the society we live in, the social and political directions we choose, and the candidates we select. We need a transformation of our religion and our politics that acknowledges that the old ways don't work. But we need more than critique. We must ask what's wrong, but also what the answers are. At its heart, we must offer a challenge to hope, which is the only real path to change. Our private religions have failed, but we must not lose a personal God. Instead of trying to strike an elusive balance between private piety and the social gospel, we must go to the heart of prophetic religion itself, in which a personal God demands public justice as an act of worship. We meet the personal God in the public arena and are invited to take our relationship to that God right into the struggle for justice. Indeed, without that personal relationship, we will lose the political struggle. That shift, bringing the personal God into the public arena, is at the heart of the prophet's message and will transform both our religion and our politics. On the eve of the Iraq War, there were massive demonstrations protesting it all over the world. But in the end, they did not stop the United States invasion. I learned something from these protests. Saying no is good, but having an alternative is better. Protest is not enough. It is necessary to show a better way. Many people will engage in protest, but even more are likely to follow an alternative that offers a better way. To offer an alternative is always more challenging than just protest. It requires more work, creativity, and risk. Like many others, I came of age during the 1960s, when the struggle for justice was embodied in the archetype of protest. We learned our lessons about politics in the streets, and the habit of protest is still deep within us. But protest can become static and formulaic. The aim of effective and transformational protest should be to illumine a society to its need for change. In other words, protest must be instructive to succeed, more than destructive. It should, at its best, point the way to an alternative, rather than just register the anger of its demonstrators. Protest must not become just a ritual of resistance, offering a laundry list of grievances. Protest should not be merely the politics of complaint. It should instead show the way for both personal and social transformation. That's what excites people and invites them to give their lives for something larger than themselves. The power of protest is not in its anger, but its invitation. The test of protest is whether it points and opens the way to change or merely denounces what is. When protest is both instructive and constructive in a society, it becomes something that has to be dealt with and not just merely contained. Those who seek alternatives to war must not underestimate the problem of evil in the world or the threat of ruthless and dangerous dictators like Saddam Hussein. It must be admitted that the peace movement sometimes does underestimate the power of evil, and in doing so, weakens its authority and its message. In their protest against the war in Iraq, some in the peace movement seem to underestimate the evil and dangers of Saddam, or, at least, failed to respond adequately to his many atrocities. The public perception was that the peace movement was not determined to oppose Saddam Hussein or to remove him from power. So those who did clearly propose to deal with Saddam appeared to be stronger than those who didn't. When a peace movement appears to be soft on the problems that war claims to be able to solve, alternative solutions will seem weak. To avoid or prevent war, we must have answers that effectively deal with the real problems and threats, but are better than war. The same principle of always looking for creative alternatives can be applied to the issue of poverty, both domestically and globally. Decrying poverty is a good thing. One in every six American children still falls below the poverty line, and one in three children of color. That is appalling in the richest nation in world history. Even worse is the 1 billion people globally, all God's children, who are forced to subsist on less than a dollar a day, and the 3 billion who live on less than $2 per day. And in a silent tsunami, 30,000 children die every day due to hunger and disease related to utterly preventable causes like the lack of clean drinking water. Those poverty facts shouldn't be tolerable to anyone across the political spectrum. But again, just to decry these facts has not solved the scandal of poverty. We need solutions, and we need them to go beyond the polarized ideological agendas of partisan politics. The conservatives are right when they say that cultural and moral issues of family breakdown, personal responsibility, sexual promiscuity, and substance abuse are prime reasons for entrenched domestic poverty. The liberals are right when they point to the critical need for adequate nutrition, health care, education, housing, and good-paying jobs as keys to overcoming endemic poverty. So why do we continue to make false choices? Poverty will only be significantly reduced by a combination of personal and social responsibility, and then only with a moral commitment that makes possible a new political will, transforming the fight against poverty into a bipartisan commitment and a nonpartisan cause. In the fight against poverty, clear and compelling alternatives are needed in every area, in education, healthcare, housing, and economic development, and in personal, family, and community renewal. Gratefully, those alternatives exist. They must be learned from, further developed, and scaled up into larger solutions in strategic partnership with a whole new set of national and international policy decisions that will effectively and dramatically reduce poverty. The spiritual component in all this is absolutely crucial. An understanding of how sacred the blessing of life is must undergird all our efforts for justice and for peace. It may be that only theology and spirituality can save the poor and the victims of war. In our new global economy, the poor are really not needed and can safely be forgotten, as can the countless refugees and casualties of war. But each of those forgotten souls was made in the image of God and carries that sacred value. To remember that is a religious duty, and to remember them is part of our obedience to God. In fact, the gospel reminds us that God is actually particularly present in those very victims when Jesus says, "As you have done it to the least of these, you have done it to me." We must never be satisfied with mere protest or complaint about the things we believe are wrong. Rather, we must do the harder, more creative, and ultimately more prophetic work of finding and offering alternatives. And we must always seek to remember and remind each other of the deeper reasons and roots for our public visions and commitments. In both instances, we will seek the biblical wisdom to choose life so that you and your children may live. The politics of God is often not the same as the politics of the people of God. The real question is not whether religious faith should influence a society and its politics, but how. As the Democratic candidates for president attended religious services during the 2004 election campaign, their worship was tempered by an uncomfortable fact. Church-going Americans tend to vote Republican. An overwhelming majority of Americans consider themselves to be religious. Yet, according to a study released in late 2003 by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, people who attend church more than once a week vote Republican by 63% to 37%. People who seldom or never attend vote Democratic by 62% to 38%. This was borne out by the 2004 exit polls. People who attend church more than once a week voted 64% for President Bush to 35% for Senator Kerry. Those who never attend voted 62% for Kerry to 36% for Bush. This disparity should concern Democrats, if not as a matter of faith, then as a matter of politics. More important, it should concern anyone who cares about the role of religion in public life. By failing to engage Republicans in this debate, the Democrats impoverish us all. The Republicans clearly have an advantage with people of faith, as recent election year results have suggested. Republicans are more comfortable talking about religious values and issues, and they are quick to promise that their faith will affect their policies, even if, like their Democratic counterparts, they don't always follow through on their campaign promises. President Bush is as public and expressive about his faith as any recent occupant of the White House. Among his first acts as president was to establish the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, which helps religious and community groups get federal financing for some of their work. Although the faith-based initiative turned out to be more symbolic than substantial, symbolism matters, in religion as well as politics. The Democratic candidates in 2004, in contrast, seemed uncomfortable with the subject of religion. The exception was Joseph Lieberman, though even he seemed less comfortable than he was in 2000. Democrats stumble over themselves to assure voters that while they may be people of faith, they won't allow their religious beliefs to affect their political views. For too many Democrats, faith is private and has no implications for political life. But what kind of faith is that? Where would America be if the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had kept his faith to himself? Faith informs policy in all areas of life. What about the biblical imperatives for social justice, the God who lifts up the poor, the Jesus who said, "Blessed are the peacemakers"? How a candidate deals with poverty is a religious issue, and the Bush administration's failure to support poor working families should be named as a religious failure. Neglect of the environment is a religious issue. Fighting preemptive and unilateral wars based on false claims is a religious issue, a fact not changed by the defeat and capture of Saddam Hussein. Such issues could have posed problems for the Bush administration among religious and non-religious people alike, if someone were to define them in moral terms. The failure of the Democrats to consistently do so is not just a political miscalculation. It shows they do not appreciate the contributions of religion to American life. As the campaign progressed, Democratic nominee John Kerry did begin to make these connections. In a speech to the National Baptist Convention, he quoted from the letter of James, "It is not enough, my brother, to say you have faith when there are no deeds. Faith without works is dead." Kerry went on to say, "As you know, my friends, we are taught to walk by faith, not by sight. And when we look around us, when we look around neighborhoods and towns and cities all across this country, we see faith to be lived out, and so many deeds to be done. We see jobs to be created. We see families to house. We see violence to stop. We see children to teach, and children to care for. We see too many people without health care, and too many people of color suffering and dying from diseases like AIDS and cancer and diabetes." But Kerry's connections were often made only in speeches to religious bodies. The United States has a long history of religious faith supporting and literally driving progressive causes and movements. From the abolition of slavery to women's suffrage to civil rights, religion has led the way for social change. The separation of church and state does not require banishing moral and religious values from the public square. In fact, America's social fabric depends on such values and vision to shape our politics, a dependence the founders recognized. It is indeed possible and necessary to express one's faith and convictions about public policy while still respecting the pluralism of American democracy. Rather than suggesting that we not talk about God, Democrats should be arguing, on moral and even religious grounds, that all Americans should have economic security, health care, and educational opportunity, and that true faith results in a compassionate concern for those on the margins. Democrats should be saying that a just foreign and military policy will not only work better, but also be more consistent with both our democratic and spiritual values. And they must offer a moral alternative to a national security policy based primarily on fear, and say what most Americans intuitively know, that defeating terrorism is both practically and spiritually connected to the deeper work of addressing global poverty and resolving the conflicts that sow the bitter seeds of despair and violence. Many of these policy choices can be informed and shaped by the faith of candidates and citizens, without transgressing the important boundaries of church and state. Everybody loves to quote the famous dictum by Lord Acton, "Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." Heads nod all around, and then everyone ignores what the wise old Englishman said. Power does indeed corrupt human beings. It compromises principles, it quiets conscience, and it mellows morality. Power tells us to just get along instead of getting upset. It encourages us towards smooth sailing, and it discourages us from rocking the boat. But it's bad theology to say that power, per se, is always bad. The Bible speaks of the power of God, the power of the gospel, and the power of truth. The New Testament Greek word dunami means spiritual power. Even political power, which is what Acton was really talking about, isn't always evil. Look at the moral power and authority that Nelson Mandela exercised to free South Africa, or that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement used to change the landscape of American life. When it comes to the issue of power and religion, I believe it is very instructive to compare the two major faith-inspired movements of the last 50 years that have tried to influence national politics. The black church-led civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, and the religious right movement of the 1980s and 1990s, exemplified by Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority and Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition. Let's call it a tale of two movements. Both were rooted in the churches. Both advanced an agenda of moral issues, and both sought to influence the direction of American life. But there were important differences. When I first learned about a book called Blinded by Might, written by two former leaders of the religious right, I was fascinated. Authors Cal Thomas and Ed Dobson, no relation to James Dobson, told the story of how the Moral Majority and their movement had been seduced by power. It recounts the exhilaration many conservative evangelicals felt when Ronald Reagan was elected president in the 1980 landslide, and how many of them, the authors included, bristled with pride when the media gave the newly organized religious right a substantial part of the credit for the victory. Thomas and Dobson were as excited as everyone else at the post-election celebration at Jerry Falwell's Liberty Baptist College in Lynchburg, Virginia. The ecstatic crowd, so proud of their pastor, who had now become a major national figure, leaped to their feet when Falwell strode into the packed auditorium as a band struck up "Hail to the Chief." Hail to the Chief? The authors said it was almost as if Jerry Falwell had been elected president. All of a sudden, conservative evangelicals who felt ignored and ridiculed for so long in the cultural backwaters of American life, almost since the infamous Scopes trial in the 1920s, were now in the national spotlight and getting their pictures taken in the Oval Office with the president. President Reagan and Reverend Jerry Falwell apparently spoke often, sometimes several times a week, as the fundamentalist minister became an insider to power. At one point, Reagan was about to appoint Sandra Day O'Connor to the Supreme Court, not the kind of unequivocal pro-life justice the religious right was hoping for. But Reagan called Falwell, saying, "Jerry, I want you to trust my judgment on this one. perhaps anxious to be a player, a winner, an insider, Falwell went along, and a series of compromises began. Direct mail strategy and fundraising came to dominate the religious right's political agenda over its previous moral concerns. Political success, defined as keeping political power, eventually became more important than the issues that initiated the formation of the religious right in the first place. It's an old story. There is no doubt that the religious right's leaders and constituency have helped to elect Republican presidents. But authors Thomas and Dobson, lamenting how little of their agenda has actually been accomplished, say the religious right has failed. On most of the issues the religious right has identified as their priorities, the culture has moved in opposite directions, despite Republican victories. Abortion rates were declining, but this is apparently due more to economic progress for poor women during the Clinton administration than to any initiatives by religious right-supported Republican presidents. And during the first term of the Bush administration, some evidence indicates that the number of abortions again rose, due to the declining status of low-income women. Pornography has exploded on the internet and cable television. Cultural acceptance for gay civil rights is expanding, despite successful state referendums against gay marriage. In comparison to the political movement of religion on the right, the civil rights struggle succeeded because it first built a movement that was morally based and politically independent. It certainly tried to change political structures and policies, but mostly operated outside of them. The movement's strength and its base were not primarily inside of politics, but rather at the grassroots. Indeed, it was the movement's outside strength and moral argument that proved key to its ultimate successes inside the political system. The Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965. Because the movement changed the way the American people thought about race and sought to affect the very cultural values of the country, it opened up the possibility of political change. The religious right, on the other hand, went for political power right away. Their strategy was less movement building and values changing than immediate electoral organizing. In fact, their hope was to take over the Republican Party, and they were successful in several states and local areas, and then implement their legislative agenda. But the critical step of persuading by moral argument and building a constituency for change was neglected. Ironically, the group that opted for an insider political strategy was ultimately relatively ignored by political power, in part because it failed to build the independent popular base and to fashion the moral argument that is so critical for real social transformation. The religious right is still an important voter base for the Republican Party, but the political discussion is now more often about how the party can keep its conservative evangelical base by appeasing it with symbols and rhetorical commitments, rather than offering real substance. We will see if that changes in a second Bush term. There have been countless books, documentaries, plays, television shows, and motion pictures telling the story of the civil rights movement. Will we be seeing anything similar about the religious right? The religious right went wrong by forgetting its religious and moral roots and going for political power. The civil rights movement was proven right in operating out of its spiritual strength and letting its political influence flow from its moral influence. Other great social causes led by religious communities, abolition of slavery, child labor reform, women's suffrage, and so on, all followed the same strategy. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, which has done extensive polling on these issues, concludes that people of faith and the institutions they build play a critical role in our nation, and these contributions are not a purely private matter. Religious beliefs play an important role in where people stand on important issues of the day. It is, of course, not a new conversation, but one that goes back to the nation's founding. The founders saw the wisdom of separating church and state, making sure there were no state-sponsored religion in the new nation or state interference in the devout diversity of the citizens' religious practice. Religion has always been a part of American politics, with frequent reference to God and faith on the part of many presidents, from George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln, to Dwight Eisenhower, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. A myriad of activist preachers and social reformers, from William Jennings Bryan to Martin Luther King Jr., from Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton to Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and James Dobson, have repeatedly invoked the language of faith for a variety of social and political purposes. At its best, faith in God has been used to hold the nation to divine accountability, as in Lincoln's expressions of collective penitence and the need for national forgiveness after the Civil War, and when King called his country to its best religious and political ideals in his letter from the Birmingham jail. But at its worst, biblical proof-texting to support ideological causes has made both religion and politics look bad. Are we on God's side? Has always been a better question than, is God on ours? Religion has and will always be a part of American politics. Again, the real question is not whether religious values should help shape our national political discussion, but how. Fundamentalism in America and elsewhere, as currently perceived and often practiced, is essentially a revolt against modernity. It is a reaction usually based on profound fear and defensiveness against losing the faith. But most of the fundamentalism in Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, and it exists in all three, does not result in what we witnessed on September 11th. That takes a shift, or a turn, to theocracy, to violence, and to a reach for power. Conventional wisdom suggests that the antidote to religious fundamentalism is more secularism, but that is a very big mistake. The best response to bad religion is better religion, not secularism. The three great monotheistic traditions are all religions of the book. The key question is, how do we interpret the book? For example, in Christian faith, we have the interpretation of Martin Luther King Jr., but also that of the Ku Klux Klan. Better interpretations of the book are a much more effective response to fundamentalism than throwing the book away. At heart, I am a 19th century evangelical. I was just born in the wrong century. Before the movement was humiliated as a result of the famous Scopes trial in 1925, fundamentalism was often socially allied with the left in supporting the kind of economic reform that would benefit its mostly working-class constituency. Evangelical and fundamentalist reformers led battles for the abolition of slavery, for child labor laws, even for women's suffrage. But after being banished to the cultural backwaters of American life, fundamentalism became an increasingly conservative and isolated enclave of defensive faith, separate from the world. It was in part the assaults on secularism that helped turn fundamentalism into the right-wing force it has become today in the United States. Of particular concern is how modern fundamentalism has made the move to theocracy in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. That move is really a betrayal of the biblical faith that regards political power much more suspiciously. Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and American fundamentalists like my old debate partners Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson are indeed all theocrats who desire their religious agenda to be enforced through the power of the state, and that is primarily a religious mistake. With the move to theocracy, modern fundamentalism too easily justifies violence as a tool for implementing its agenda. The fatal attraction of fundamentalism to violence is certainly at stake in the crisis of terrorism. It is evident in Islamic calls for holy war against the West, but also in the Christian right's denunciation of all Islam and its religious affirmation of the war against terrorism, with the language of crusade much too close to the political surface. The fundamentalist arguments for violence quickly become more political than religious. I remember my debates with the Reverend Jerry Falwell about nuclear weapons. We would be talking about the potential annihilation of hundreds of millions of people. And yet his arguments were always more political than religious. the little bracelet on the wrists of so many teenagers today that reads WWJD, What Would Jesus Do?, gets quickly to the heart of the violence debate. It's always striking to me that when I listen to the Christian fundamentalist justifications for violence, I don't hear them asking that question. What would Jesus do? From a fundamentalist Christian point of view, shouldn't that be the key question to ask? What is more fundamental to Christianity than Jesus? Perhaps the teachings of Jesus, most unpopular with Christian fundamentalists, and other Christians too, are his statements about loving our enemies, and not just seeing the specks in your adversary's eye, but also the log in your own. Genuine faith, in all our traditions, either forbids violence as a methodology, or at most, says it must always be limited and lamented, never glorified or celebrated. True religion always seeks alternatives to violence that try to break its deadly cycle. Modern fundamentalism, instead, offers what Walter Wink calls the myth of redemptive violence, that somehow violence can save us after all. The lesson of September 11th must not be to relegate religion to the private sphere. Rather, the future of politics must become a discourse about values, which includes moral and religious ones. We should talk less about the ideological categories of left and right, and more about what kind of people we want to be, what kind of community, what kind of world. Even those who don't trust organized religion often do want to talk about spiritual or moral values. Applying spiritual values to politics will be the key. The Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu is a good example of that endeavor. As chair of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Tutu provided a clear and compelling example of how to deal with the societal conflicts we must resolve if we're going to move forward, and how the cycle of revenge and violence can be broken and even healed. Tutu continually speaks of the need for a spirituality of transformation, one that can even change politics. Today there are new fundamentalists in the land. These are the secular fundamentalists, many of whom attack all political figures who dare to speak from their religious convictions. From the Anti-Defamation League to Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, to the ACLU and some of the political left's most religion-fearing publications. A cry of alarm has gone up in response to anyone who has the audacity to be religious in public. These secular skeptics often display an amazing lapse of historical memory when they suggest that religious language in politics is contrary to the American ideal. The truth is just the opposite. As we have discussed, many of the most progressive social movements in American history, anti-slavery, women's suffrage, the fight for child labor laws, and the civil rights movement, had overt religious roots and motivations. Why do so many liberals seem supportive of religious language when it is invoked by black civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr., but recoil when such language is employed by white political leaders? Is there a subtle kind of racism going on, where religion is okay for liberals as long as it comes from black or poor people? Are black people supposed to be culturally religious, love those black choirs, while white believers are intellectually suspect? Secular fundamentalists make a fundamental mistake. They believe that the separation of church and state ought to mean the separation of faith from public life. While it is true that some conservative religionists do want to blur the boundaries between church and state, most advocates of religious and moral values in the public square do not. Most of us do not support state-sanctioned prayer in public schools, or school-backed prayers at high school football games in the South, or huge granite blocks inscribed with the Ten Commandments in every courthouse. A good and fair discussion of how a candidate's faith shapes his or her political values should be viewed as a positive thing. It's as relevant and appropriate as many other facts about a politician's background, convictions, and experience for public office. The more talk about values, the better in political campaigns. And religion is a primary source of values for many Americans. clearly, minority religions and non-religious people must always be respected and protected in our nation. But the core commitments of religious liberty need not be compromised by an open discussion of faith and public life. Indeed, the right kind of talk about religion and politics represents, according to astute political observer and columnist E.J. Dionne, not a threat to religious liberty, but its triumph. The secular fundamentalists tell us that religion should be restricted to one's church or family. No talk of faith, they seem to be saying, ought to be allowed to seep into the public arena for fear of violating the First Amendment or alienating the non-religious. Perhaps we should make sure all our church and living room windows are shut tight so that no words of faith are overheard in the wider society. When vice presidential candidate and devout Jew Joe Lieberman said, "The Constitution guarantees freedom of religion, not freedom from religion," one of his most virulent critics was prompted to admit that she really did want a society free from religion. Fortunately, the Constitution protects the free speech of believing and unbelieving citizens. The secular fundamentalists want to hide faith under a bushel, but the gospel specifically instructs us not to do that. The purpose of biblical faith is not simply to comfort the believers, but to transform the world. But that must always be done in ways that both respect religious liberty and enhance democracy. Catholic teaching says it well. Religious faith should serve the common good, and with practitioners like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., religious faith should help bend the world toward justice. Prophecy is not future-telling, but articulating moral truth. The prophets diagnose the present and point the way to a just solution. The prophetic tradition in all of the world's great religions is just what we need to open up our contemporary political options, which are, honestly, grossly failing to solve our most pressing social problems. The competing ideological options from which we are forced to choose are perhaps at their lowest ebb in compelling the involvement of ordinary citizens in public life. It is not that people just don't care, but that they feel unrepresented and unable to vote for anything that expresses their best values. That is a serious political crisis, and we need better options. What would it mean to evaluate the leading current political options by the values of the prophets? What would happen if we asserted that values are the most important subject for the future of politics? What if we proposed a prophetic politics? The current problem is that politics is still run by ideological polarities that leave many people feeling left out. There are now three major political options in our public life. The first political option in America today is conservative on everything, from cultural, moral, and family concerns to economic, environmental, and foreign policy issues. Differences emerge between aggressive nationalists and cautious isolationists, corporate apologists and principled fiscal conservatives. But this is the political option clearly on the ascendancy in America, with most of the dominant ideas in the public square coming from the political right. The second political option in contemporary America is liberal on everything. Both family, sexual, cultural questions, and economic, environmental, and foreign policy matters. There are certainly differences among the liberals, from pragmatic centrists to green leftists, but the intellectual and ideological roots come from the left side of the cultural and political spectrum, and today most from the liberal left find themselves on the defensive. The third option in American politics is libertarian, meaning liberal on cultural moral issues and conservative on fiscal, economic, and foreign policy. The just leave me alone and don't spend my money option is growing quickly in American life. I believe there is a fourth option for American politics, which follows from the prophetic religious tradition we have described. It is traditional or conservative on issues of family values, sexual integrity, and personal responsibility, while being very progressive, populist, or even radical on issues like poverty and racial justice. It affirms good stewardship of the earth and its resources, supports gender equality, and is more internationally minded than nationalist, looking first to peacemaking and conflict resolution when it comes to foreign policy questions. The people it appeals to, many religious but others not, are very strong on issues like marriage, raising kids, and individual ethics, but without being right-wing, reactionary, or mean-spirited or scapegoating against any group of people such as homosexuals. They can be pro-life, pro-family, and pro-feminist all at the same time. They think issues of moral character are very important, both in a politician's personal life and in his or her policy choices. Yet they are decidedly pro-poor, for racial reconciliation, critical of purely military solutions, and defenders of the environment. At the heart of the fourth option is the integral link between personal ethics and social justice, and it appeals to the people who refuse to make the choice between the two. Who are these people? Many are religious, Catholics, Black and Hispanic Christians, evangelicals who don't identify with the religious right, and members of all our denominational churches who want to put their faith into practice. They are Jews and Muslims who are guided by an active faith and not just a personal background. They are people who do not consider themselves religious, but rather spiritual. And they are people, religious, spiritual or not, who consider themselves shaped by a strong sense of moral values and who long for a political commitment that reflects them. As I travel the country, I find many people who share this perspective. Still, it is not yet a political option. It should be. As one who has called for a new